As you all know, we're going to have the final exam on Friday, and a number of you asked me about the exam, and in particular whether it's going to be cumulative, that is to say whether it's going to cover the whole of the course. The answer there is that the first question, where you're supposed to put the main events in chronological order, will cover the entire course. But the bulk of the exam, all the other questions, are going to focus on the period since the midterm. It's going to have pretty much the same format as the midterm exam. It's just designed to test your basic understanding of the material covered in the course, the basic events and so on, basic policies, things like the logic created by the Schlieffen Plan. Why was it, for example, that a Russian general mobilization would touch off a European war? Basic things of that sort. Plus, you should also be tested on your understanding of the readings, at the basic point of the various readings were. And also, on Friday, I'll give you the topic for the second part of the final exam, which is the take-home part. You saw what it is in general terms from the syllabus. It's just here you have this argument developed by Kenneth Waltz about how international politics works in a world of sovereign states, how it's the system that's responsible for war and so on. Drawing on what you've learned in the course of the quarter, what do you make of that argument? Right? And I should say, it's a take-home exam. It's very different from an in-class exam. I don't have any objection to working together on the take-home exam in little groups. There's no way of preventing it anyway, so let's make a virtue out of necessity. Do any of you have any questions about any of this stuff? Yeah? And then you develop new military plans to suit those changed circumstances. Right? You can't plan for everything. Right? You have to make certain assumptions about what the underlying political situation is, and a military plan is worked up to deal with that situation. All right. As for today's lecture and the lecture on Wednesday, on Wednesday I'm going to try and pull everything together. What's the meaning of all of this stuff? What is it? What is all the stuff that we've covered tell us about these basic issues that people interested in international relations are concerned with? This two great issues. What makes for war? The other side of that coin is what makes for a stable international system. And the second issue is related to that. It's like, okay, so therefore, what makes for good foreign policy? Are there general principles that you could point to that should guide foreign policy in a general way? Right? So we want to kind of massage the historical material to get insight into those really basic questions. So that's what I'm going to do next time. Today, it's going to be a relatively short lecture. I want to try and end at 10:30 because I have to give out the course evaluations. You're supposed to get about 20 minutes to do the evaluation. So, okay. So, where are we so far? Last time I was talking about American intervention in the war. What was the background there? Here you had this war between the Triple Entente and the Central Powers. And it was essentially a military stalemate for the first couple of years. The Schlieffen Plan failed. On the other hand, the Entente powers were unable to defeat Germany either. And in spite of these absolutely massive efforts, the military front, especially in the West, was fairly stable in the course of the war. Right, so in that situation, you think, well, why didn't people then opt for a compromised peace, negotiated peace? And we talked about why that was ruled out. Not totally rational. Okay? Why that was ruled out. And if that's ruled out, and the war is going to be fought to its bitter end, and one side or the other is going to win, then you have to be concerned with anything that would break the stalemate, anything that would be decisive, anything that would determine the outcome of the war. And in fact, this reaching for decisive action had two aspects to it, one military and the other political. And they were, in fact, tightly connected. The military one was, you maybe if you develop some weapon, it could knock your principal adversary out of the war. Right? So the Germans had developed a submarine. Britain is dependent on overseas imports. If you have a submarine blockade, use those submarines to sink those merchant vessels, bringing all this food and supplies into Britain, and you knock the British out of the war. Yeah, this is going to bring the Americans in. But the hope was that the British could be knocked out of the war before the American intervention became effective, because the United States didn't really have an army to speak of. It was going to take a long time to develop a serious armed force and bring it to bear on the battlefields of France. Okay, so you had this hope for a decision. And then kind of connected with that is the hope for the intervention of neutrals, of fresh blood, and above all, of the most important neutral power in the world, the country whose economic strength and therefore whose war-making capability rivaled that of all of Europe as a whole, the United States. America is already by far the premier industrial power of the world. Right? And in fact, the submarine war brought in the Americans. And it was only in 1918 that American military power was really brought to bear. And even then, people were pretty sure that the war was going to last a whole other year into 1919. Okay? So this is reaching for decision. And you'll note that the emphasis is on the war in the West. And so it's somewhat ironic that a decision did come, not in the West, but in the East in 1917. Right? Russia left the war. Russia was defeated, above all by these internal political changes, which are very much to be understood in the context of the war. The Russian Revolution in 1917, actually, there were two revolutions. There was first the so-called February Revolution, which took place in March, and then when that didn't bring about an end to the war, the Bolsheviks were able to seize power in November. The October Revolution, they still had the old Julian calendar. That's why there was that confusion about the months. And the Bolshevik revolution led to the end of the war in the East. In fact, there was a formal peace settlement between the Bolshevik regime in Moscow and the German government. That was signed in March 1918. This is the famous Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. Treaty of Brest-Litovsk established not German annexation of that whole area, but German dominance of all these areas in the East, including the Ukraine, which had been part of the Russian Empire for a very long time. Technically independent governments, but supported by German arms and under the political influence of Germany. Right? This corresponded to a German vision of really dramatic political change in Europe. The emergence of Germany as by far the number one power, the hegemonic power in the continent of Europe. And the notion that Germany had to create what was called, Mittelalter, a kind of economic and ultimately political and military bloc in Central Europe and East Central Europe. This was rooted in the sense that to stand up to this coalition of naval powers, Germany needed to control a large landmass in the continent, because naval power was proving its value during the war. The country that controlled the seas could choke off imports into Germany in the event of war. Okay. But perhaps even more important, even more revealing of German goals at this point than the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk and the fact of the other arrangements and developments that had taken place in the East, like the collapse of the Italian front at Caporetto in the end of 1917, and then the defeat of Romania and the imposition of rather rigorous peace terms on Romania in May of 1918, the Treaty of Bucharest. They kind of basically also integrated Romania into this Mitteleuropa structure. It's supposed to be permanent, not just for the duration of the war. Even more important than all of that was a fundamental decision that the German government made as a result of the collapse of Russia and its developments in the East. There were people who said, this enables us to approach the Western powers with a program for compromise peace. They recognize our position in the East. In exchange for that, we accommodate them in the West. We give back Alsace-Lorraine. Right? It still would have left Germany as the hegemonic power in Europe. This was the program of the foreign ministry, principal champion of this line of thinking was named Richard Kuhlmann. The military would have nothing of it. In the course of the war, power had devolved into the hands of the military. There was the personal rule of the Kaiser was replaced by a kind of military dictatorship headed by General Ludendorff. Kaiser was still there, but he had become much more of a figurehead. And Ludendorff and people who thought like him would have nothing of this sort of strategy. No compromise. Germany had won in the East. Germany was going to win in the West. These people were gamblers. And the whole notion was, a good chance that Britain could be knocked out of the war. Right? It's a good chance that Germany could win in the West. Germany could defeat France. And they had a strategy, really a new tactic, for overcoming the military stalemate in the West before the American army really became effective. This was a strategy based on the notion of shock troops. You take the best, the most hardened fighters from all these German units, organize them into shock troops, prepare them, train them extremely well for kind of the tactical offensive. And the hope was that this would break the Allied defenses in northern France. After all, with Russia out of the war, Germany could then concentrate more of her forces in the West. Right? These things didn't work. There's a huge German gamble in 1917, 1918, failed. The gamble of the submarine war failed. Why? Two reasons. For military countermeasures, in particular the institution of the convoy system, which enabled the Allied shipping to be escorted by Allied naval vessels who were capable of conducting anti-submarine operations. And also by a political development, which was the rationalization of the Allied import programs. Right? And a whole system came into being at this point. Based on the notion that the allies acting together through organisms that they would set up for this purpose, the main one of which was called the Allied Maritime Transport Council, the Allies would allocate shipping in a way that corresponded to the most urgent needs of all the Allies without regard to nationality, without regard to ability to pay or ability to carry. You know, it was a rationalized system instead of the previous system where shipping was allocated according to whoever was screaming the loudest, basically. They call it the system of competitive panics that people were dealing with. Right? And the whole, and so there's this, this system for the control of all of the Allied imports, basically all of transatlantic trade, all of Europe's foreign trade, because Germany wasn't doing very much of it. And the hope was, on the part of people like the French, that this system would survive into the post-war period and would be an effective means of controlling Germany, because you would be able to ration Germany's access to overseas imports, overseas markets. Okay? British had a certain interest in this. The Americans were a lot cooler. But they still didn't dismiss it out of hand. And then on the land battlefield, there was a very important development, which was the introduction of the tank, which was pushed by civilians. Yeah. It's like, in a sense, the tank is kind of the obvious answer to barbed wire and machine guns and trench warfare. If you want to get away from the kind of war you had and restore a war of movement, the tank is the answer. And the tank is not a complicated development. Basically, the Caterpillar tractor had been developed before the war for agricultural purposes. It's basically a question of adding armor and armament to a Caterpillar tractor, right? But the military were reluctant, just they had been reluctant to accommodate to the implications of the machine gun in the pre-war period. Okay. So Germany, having shot her wad, is in no position to carry on the war, and the German front begins to crumble. The Germans are still in northern France. They haven't retreated to the Rhine. The German front begins to crumble. It's clear now the Germans can't hope for total victory. It's clear now, with all these fresh American troops flooding in, that the situation for Germany is going to go from bad to worse. And so what happens is that the German political leadership, going through the Swiss, approach the Allies and ask for peace terms. Would they be willing to consider peace on the basis of President Wilson's program? President Wilson had announced a peace program, his famous 14-point speech in January of 1918, and then he gave these subsequent speeches. It's the civilian leadership that's approaching. It's the military, you know, having gotten Germany into this mess, doesn't want to take responsibility for these actions which would lead to a recognition of Germany's defeat. Right? So the ball's now in the hands of the Allies. Here's the problem. What was the Wilsonian program? It's a very ambiguous program, right? Wilson is not talking about peace among equals, peace without victory, a negotiated peace, a compromise peace. He had used that language, but in January 1917, the famous peace without victory speech, before the United States entered the war. As soon as the United States entered the war, the whole tone of Wilson's speeches shifted quite dramatically. If we had been forced to enter this war, it was only because, you know, the Germans had revealed themselves for what they were, namely a criminal power, because otherwise the United States wouldn't have gone to war against them. And this great crime that they had committed, sufficient to provoke American entry into the war, this should be punished. If you believe in the rule of law, if you believe in international norms, well then, obviously, the lawbreaker should be punished. And it was obviously Germany who was responsible. So you have this shift, this kind of change in the whole Wilson attitude toward, we can't make a compromise peace with these people. Their regime is responsible for this whole thing. It has to be destroyed. And if it can't be destroyed, then we're gonna have to treat them pretty harshly. Shut out from the peaceful intercourse with the rest of the world, he said. Okay? The Germans like to kind of focus on the more positive aspects of the Wilson program. It's rejection of power politics, it's belief in, a new, world of peace and democracy and so on. And they kind of deliberately ignored a lot of the more negative things. But which way is it going to go? It's very much up for grabs. Okay, so that's this kind of very general problem. There's this immediate problem of how you're going to respond to these German peace overtures. Basically, Wilson and the Allies make it clear to Germany that the kind of peace that they can expect will depend on the sort of regime that they have. If they keep the Kaiser and the whole imperial apparatus, the whole military clique, these people who would cause the war in the view of people like Wilson were allowed to remain in power, then there's going to be a harsh peace. If, on the other hand, the Germans saw the error of their ways and changed their institutions and converted to democracy and so on, well, this would be a much softer peace, a more lenient peace. Right? And that's the context within which you have to understand the political developments that took place in Germany in November 1918. The German Revolution of November 1918, which overthrew the Kaiser. The Kaiser had to abdicate. He fled to Holland. But the very fact that those changes had taken place in that environment made them suspect. Was this a genuine conversion to democracy? Or are the Germans just making these cosmetic changes so that they can get the best deal from the Allies? People were aware of all these things. It was unclear. And what that meant was, we can't give away too much. We can't count too much on a genuine German conversion to democracy. We have to subject them, in Ms. Wilson's phrase, to a generation of thoughtfulness. They're going to have to show that they're really sorry for what they did, make amends for their crimes, repent, basically. And then we'll take them back. But for the time being, we don't really trust them. That's the mentality in which the pre-armistice agreement is negotiated. Yeah. A generation of thoughtfulness. Right. Okay. So that's the context. And an agreement is worked out. A pre-armistice agreement is worked out. Right. Then the fact that World War I was ended with an agreement is very important. This was not an unconditional surrender of Germany. The Germans surrendered while they were still in France. The war, not even at this point, was being fought on German soil. Okay? What did the pre-armistice agreement provide for? It provided that the peace would be based on the principles that President Wilson had outlined in his 14-point speech and in subsequent addresses, with these two clarifications or modifications. One was that one of the 14 points had called for freedom of the seas, and basically they said, there's a lot of difference of opinion about freedom of the seas, we don't want to be bound by this. Well, what was going on here? Freedom of the seas meant the British couldn't use blockade. Blockade is the principal instrument of a powerful navy. To say that you should have freedom of the seas in time of war, except for, just contraband of war, meant that the sort of naval strategy that the British had implemented would no longer be acceptable. So the it amounted to the neutralization of the principal form of British power, namely naval power. So you couldn't have freedom of the seas. Ironically, this was the ostensible issue that the Americans had entered the war over. Okay. And then the second point had to do with reparations. A number of the provisions in the 14 points called upon Germany to restore the areas that had been devastated by the war, especially northern France, damages done to Belgium, but also in the east. Right? And according to the pre-armistice agreement, this was defined to mean that Germany would make reparation for the damage done by the aggression of Germany to the civilian population of the Allies. Implying a little bit more than just the restoration of the physical devastation that had been, that had resulted from the war in northern France. Because here the feeling was it was just France that would get the reparations. Britain wouldn't get anything. The British wanted to keep their options open. Okay. What's the importance, again, of this the pre-armistice agreement? the main point to note here is that this arrangement that terminated the war, it was neither fish nor fowl. Okay. Not unconditional surrender, not a negotiated peace either. Germany was to prevent it, according to the terms of the pre-armistice agreement, from being able to continue the fighting. Germany was to surrender all kinds of armaments and things like that. And what this meant was that the terms of the peace would be dictated, in effect, by the three great Western democracies, Britain, France, and the United States. They were the ones who would interpret the pre-armistice agreement. They were the ones who would interpret the 14 points, the Wilson Program, in all of its ambiguities. Right? And again, don't forget, if you're someone who thinks in terms of justice, then just a moralist like Wilson thinks in those terms. Well, doesn't justice mean that the criminal nation should not be allowed to get off scot-free? Right? There are all those aspects to Wilson's thing. And if the Allies interpret their obligations in those terms and have the power to work up peace terms that are in line with that whole philosophy, well, then that's going to be at variance with the German interpretation, because the Germans are going to focus on the more moderate aspects of the Wilson Program. You compare the kind of peace that you got, not just the kind of peace you got, but the way the war ended in 1918, from the way things ended in 1945, or for that matter, with the end of the Napoleonic Wars and the kind of basic philosophy that was in play at that point. This 1918 peace, for all the German complaints, was not a harsh peace along the lines of the 1945 peace. The war ended before German territory was touched, right? Germany was left intact. Germany retained a sovereign government. After 1945, Germany was occupied. Germany was under the control of the occupying powers. Germany was eventually divided. Germany was subject to much more severe constraints on her power. And yet 1945 was accepted in a way 1918 wasn't. Again, this is this neither fish nor fowl aspect of it. Harsh enough to infuriate the Germans, but not harsh enough to break their power totally. To give it, especially with the collapse of Russian power in the East. Where's the counterweight to Germany? You compare it with 1815, totally different philosophy, right? Here, you want to reintegrate France. You're not looking to punish France. Your eyes are on the future, not on the past. You're not thinking moralistic terms. You're not thinking in terms of justice. You're thinking in terms of equilibrium and balance of power. Right? You don't find that in 1918. So it's neither one nor the other. It's not an integrationist piece, and it's not a Carthaginian piece. The aim is neither to destroy German power nor to reintegrate Germany. Now, that's a recipe for serious problems. And in fact, the end of the war in 1918 was not going to mark the end of international conflict. It would be the beginning of a whole new series of complications and difficulties that would ultimately culminate in a second great war. The war of 1939, a much worse war, a much more dangerous war than the First World War, as we all know. You look at all the stuff, and I'll just end here with this same point that I ended the lecture with last time. This armistice 1918, this style of conducting policy, the arrangements that were worked out, the peace that they led to, this was the only great peace in the history of international politics, great power politics, to be dictated by the three Western democracies and by them alone. You can't say that about 1815, you can't say that about 1945. And yet it was far less stable than either of them. And you gotta wonder whether there's any connection between those two things. You know, here we are in a democracy, we're always patting ourselves on the back about how wonderful it is to be in a democracy, you know, the democratic peace and all this kind of thing. You look at this story, you say, there must be more to this problem than that. All right, so let me end there. And